So welcome everyone to this mini-series on Torah, Rationalism and Science. I'll introduce myself. My name is Nathan Slifkin, and I've been fascinated by the interplay between Torah and the natural sciences for a long time now, for nearly 20 years. And it has led me also towards a study of rationalism, as we'll see. As you may have heard, a couple of years ago, going on now to 7 years ago, I got in a little bit of trouble when a few of my books were put in cheirim by one or two or three dozen rabbinic authorities in the Haredi world. And it was very hard for me to understand it, because as far as I was concerned, I hadn't even written anything novel in any of my books. The books that were banned, as far as I knew, as far as I thought, I was just relaying approaches of classical authorities such as Rambam, Rabbi Shimshon of Fall Hirsch, and so on. There wasn't even anything novel in them, and yet, for my opponents, my distinguished opponents, my books were absolute utter heresy. So it was a very challenging period. If you'd like to find out more about that whole episode, I have everything documented at www.zootorah.com. Controversy, or controversy, depending on whether you're British or American. There's the link in the text box. Through trying to understand the whole episode, what I realized is that there's two very different approaches to Judaism as a whole. Two very different schools of thought. And they are squats, and you see, it's very hard to come up with a good label for the other one. I sometimes call the other school of thought the mystical school of thought, which is not exactly the right term. I sometimes say the non-rationalist. I guess non-rationalist is the most precise. It doesn't really, it's just phrasing in the negative. It doesn't tell you anything specifically about that school of thought in a positive sense. So I prefer to go with mystical. It's not exactly the right term, but in general, I think mystical is the closest to the correct term that we're looking for. But I may sometimes, in the course of this presentation, use the term non-rationalist. I'm not going to use the term irrational, partly because it's offensive, and partly because this whole school of thought, it's not really so much about rational, it's about rationalist. And hopefully we'll explain what those differences are. Now, from the outset, what I want to say is that even though my books were banned for presenting the rationalist approach, the goal of this presentation is not to delegitimize the non-rationalist approach. For reasons that I hope I'll remember to get to at the end, I believe that the non-rationalist approach is a traditional part of Judaism, and it's something that's valuable, something that's important. But the goal of this talk is to explain the two different schools of thought, and, you know, obviously, because my inclination is towards a rationalist school of thought, I'm going to be, as much as I try to maintain a neutral, objective standpoint, I'm inevitably going to be somewhat biased towards a rationalist school of thought. But the truth is, it's the one that needs more of a hearing because it's been suppressed so much in recent years, so people are less familiar with it. But as I say, my goal is not to delegitimize the non-rationalist school of thought. It's to, I believe that both are necessary, both are valuable. And the goal of this presentation is really to just explain the two different approaches. Okay, so the key features of rationalist Judaism can really be divided into three areas. I'm going to try cutting and pasting something onto the screen here. Let's just figure out how I can do it. A whiteboard, that's what I need. Here we go, here's a whiteboard. So the first area that we're going to discuss is knowledge. And I'm going to come up with a definition here. I'm going to paste something into the screen. Oh, this might be paste. Hold on. Let's see. Okay, can you see that on the screen? Can you just type it in the text chat box if you can see it? Yes? No? No? Okay, tech support, how do I share this screen? I think maybe you have to minimize the screen where you can see me to the side.
Let's try that one again.
Okay, you got it? Rationalists believe that knowledge is legitimately obtained by man via his reasoning and senses, and should preferably be based upon evidence or reason rather than faith, especially for far-fetched claims. Okay, you got it back? You got it? Okay. Now, from the outset, I should say that when I'm speaking about rationalists, I'm speaking about a school of thought which, in its heyday, was pioneered by Rambam, by Maimonides, and by the Rishonim and the Torah scholars of the medieval period in Sfarad. It's not exactly the same as rationalism today, for reasons which I'll explain. There is a certain crossover, but that's primarily what I'm talking about. Okay, so that's what rationalists believe. Knowledge. That rational, and this is what really all comes down to, that rationalists believe in the power of the human mind to use logic and to draw upon evidence in order to attain knowledge. Whereas, in contrast to that, mystics, let me just cut and paste the definition for mystics. Mystics are skeptical of the ability of the human mind to arrive at truths and prefer to base knowledge on revelation, or for those who are not worthy of revelation, and faith in those who do experience revelation. So it's two different paths to knowledge, two different approaches to how knowledge ideally should be and is obtained. Now, what I'd like to do is give some examples of how that plays out in order to understand what it is I'm talking about. So one example is belief in God. And here's an area where you see a difference between the medieval rationalist approach and the contemporary rationalist approach. So for the medieval rationalists, belief in God meant knowledge, and that meant knowledge which was acquired via philosophy, via philosophical arguments. And of course, it's most obvious with Rambam, but also with other Torah scholars of that period. The idea is that belief in God is not based on, ideally, not based on blind faith, and not based on supernatural revelation, on experiencing miracles. It's based on the mind. It's based on using the brain to work through logical, philosophical proofs and arrive at awareness, figure out that God exists. Whereas the non-rationalist approach is very suspicious of this whole philosophy endeavor, for a very good reason. And they say belief in God should ideally be based on revelation, right, a supernatural experience, or on emunah pashuta, blind faith, simple faith. Right, but not based on logic or philosophy. And now, as I mentioned, there's a difference between medieval rationalists and modern rationalists. In the medieval period, they believed that it is possible to logically prove the foundational truths of Judaism. Whereas in modern times, it's generally not believed that these things can be philosophically proved. We realize that much more the limitations of philosophy. There's still some people today who are what I call modern medieval rationalists. Right? They're still living in the intellectual framework of the 13th century and believe that you can philosophically prove the truths of Judaism. But in general, it's accepted that these things, it's no longer accepted that these things can be philosophically proven. And you have to use other means to obtain faith. Okay, so that's as far as the difference between rationalists and mystics with regard to knowledge is the ramification with regard to belief in God. Now, I'd like to speak about another example that's very close to my heart, and it's the way in which I came onto this, which is the scientific knowledge of Chazal, and the scientific knowledge of the sages of the Talmud. Because this is really how I came onto this whole topic. So, again, the primary issue involved in the banning of my books was saying that some of the things in the Talmud, some of the descriptions of the natural world, of the animal kingdom in the Talmud, are not scientifically correct, which, as far as I was concerned, was obviously true and non-controversial and traditional. Whereas for my opponents, it was obviously false and absolutely innovative and heretical. So how is that possible? How is it possible that the people in my camp and the people in my opponents' camps have such radically different views to this? Surely it should be very simple to resolve. What I realize is that it all comes down to these different schools of thought, and it all comes down to epistemology. Right? Epistemology means how knowledge is obtained. And let's see how it plays out in this example of the scientific knowledge. The rationalist approach believes that knowledge is legitimately obtained by figuring things out. So how does that apply in this case? It means that it applies in this case in many different ways. It means that when the sages of the Talmud made a statement about the natural world, it was based on what they figured out. Right? And when and there were certain authorities, Rambam and many others, who said that the statements of the sages were based on what they figured out and were therefore not infallible. And how do Rambam and these authorities know that? Because it's based on what they figured out. And nowadays, some of these statements appear to be contradicted by science, i.e. by what people have figured out today, which is considered to be a fairly reliable source of knowledge. Right? And I figured out that this is the case, and that it's legitimate to rely on these authorities who said that it's what Chazal figured out. Right? And therefore I figured out that it's okay to say that the Chazal, these statements from the Gemara, are not scientifically accurate. Again, it's not reflecting badly on the sages of the Talmud in any way. It doesn't mean they were very smart people, very wise people. It's just the fact that, you know, knowledge progresses. And people were able to stand on the achievements of people of earlier generations. And therefore, you know, we're now aware that, for example, creatures do not spontaneously generate. But at every stage, it's the idea that knowledge is obtained via figuring things out. Chazal said what they said based on what they figured out. The Rishonim said that that's what happened because that's what they figured out. Modern science has figured out otherwise, and I figured out what modern science said, and it's legitimate to rely on those Torah authorities who said that Chazal said what they said based on what they figured out. Right, so at every stage, the epistemology involved is the idea that knowledge is obtained by figuring things out. The non-rationalist approach, on the other hand, is very skeptical of the ability of the human brain to figure things out, and it places much greater weight on knowledge that's obtained via supernatural sources. So for non-rationalists, when the sages of the Talmud made statements about the natural world, it wasn't based on what they figured out. On the contrary, the knowledge was based on a much higher source. It was based on supernatural revelation. Right? The sages of the Talmud, they had divine inspiration. They were privy to secret supernatural knowledge. And that was the basis of even the statements they made, not just about Torah, but about the natural world. Right? And therefore, of course, it's infallible. And science, on the other hand, which contradicts these statements, what do scientists know? Right? These scientists are just working with the human brain, which is an unreliable, very fallible source of knowledge. Scientists are contradicting themselves all the time. You know, they claim to know what happened millions of years ago, but they don't even know what the weather's going to be in 2 weeks' time, as one of my opponents famously said. So, therefore, the idea. So we're very. Whereas the sage's knowledge is based on divine inspiration, supernatural revelation, is extremely reliable, or ultimately reliable. The knowledge of modern science is not reliable. And how do we know all this? Based on what the Torah, certain other Torah scholars throughout the generations have said. And how do they know this? Because also they had Ruach HaKodesh, they had divine inspiration. And especially, my opponents would say, you know, the Gedolim of today, the Haredi leading Torah scholars of today, when they say that this is the way to go, they are blessed with divine guidance with Ruach HaKodesh, the Yad HaDishmaya, and so on. So at every step of the way, the epistemology is completely different. Right? That for my opponents, that knowledge is ideally obtained not by figuring things out, but instead by a supernatural revelation. And you see why the gap is so unbridgeable, because it's a completely different mindset with regard to how knowledge is ideally obtained. So that for me is a very potent example of the difference between rationalists and non-rationalists. Let's give another example which plays into this. In fact, it's a story from the Gemara, which my opponents in the whole controversy over Torah and science often cited. And the story is as follows. Well, there's two parallel stories from the Gemara. One story is that Rabbi Yochanan makes a drasha, and he says that in the Messianic era, when God will rebuild Jerusalem, he will make the windows of Jerusalem out of gemstones that are 30 amos square, that are 45 feet square. And so one of the Talmudim laughs and mocks this and says, come on, there's no such thing. You can't have gemstones and gems and pearls that big, there's no such thing. And the Gemara continues that the student went sailing out on the ocean and he happened to see some angels who were hewing out such gigantic gemstones. So the student goes back to Rabbi Yochanan and he says, now I believe it, because I've seen it with my own eyes. I've had it empirically confirmed. And Rabbi Yochanan says, you know, you scoffer, have you not seen it with your own eyes? Do you not have believed it? And he gives them a look and turns them to a heap of bones. So according to my opponents, you know, certainly at face value, this story in the Gemara is a very powerful argument for the non-rationalist perspective. Right? It's saying that Rabbi Yochanan's statement should be accepted, even though it contradicts science for what the scientists know. Scientists don't know anything. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't know why, presumably because he has Ruach HaKodesh, some kind of divine inspiration, supernatural power behind his words. And the student is castigated for only believing it when it's empirically confirmed. Right, that's the wrong approach. Empiricism doesn't mean anything. It's really the authority, the unimpeachable authority of the Yochanan that should be accepted. So, you know, seems to be a very powerful argument for the non-rationalists. However, you know, Rambam also learnt this Gemara. So, you know, there's an entire rationalist school of thought amongst the Rosh Hashanah Sfarad. And they also learnt this Gemara. And they had a whole different take in this entire Gemara. According to them, when Rabbi Yochanan said that God is going to rebuild Jerusalem with these gigantic gemstones, and there's a parallel story with Rabbi Gamliel saying that in the Messianic era, loaves of bread and cakes are going to grow on trees. Right, so of course they didn't mean it literally, according to these Rishonim, because there's no such thing. Right? Because scientifically we know there's no such thing, so of course it's not meant literally. Instead, it's a metaphor. And the problem with the student is that he accepted these as literal accounts. And what he should have realized is that when the other people are not stupid, of course they're not speaking literally, that was the student's error. Excuse me. And the idea of the student sailing out onto the sea and learning otherwise is also not meant literally. What it means is that he sailed out into the Sea of Talmud, he increased his intellectual horizons, and then realized that it wasn't meant for. So the rationalist Rosh Hashanah had a completely different approach to this whole Gemara. So it's fascinating. This same story in the Gemara, you know, this really shows how far apart the two schools of thought are. For the non-rationalists, this story was a condemnation of rationalism. And for the rationalists, this story was a condemnation of non-rationalism. Right, so this shows you the tremendous chasm that separates the two sides. And I have a full study of that story in the Gemara I published in Chakira. And you can find it online. It's linked to my website, rationalistjudaism.com, and on the right-hand side. Let's give another example. Kazayas. Wait, hold on. So Stanley is asking, how do the rationalists explain the Yochanan's reaction? Have you not seen it? Will you not have believed it? Good question. So how do they explain his reaction? If I recall, that according to them, Rabbi Yochanan is saying, I don't know how they would explain it. Can't remember. Maybe I've discussed it in my article. It's been a couple of years now. Incidentally, I would say that here's another difference between medieval rationalists and contemporary rationalists or contemporary academics. Whereas the medieval rationalists would often interpret these stories non-literally. So certainly contemporary academic approach would not be to interpret the story non-literally. It would be to accept it as intended in its literal meaning, but to say that it's some kind of legend. And that would be a very big difference between, say, the medieval rationalist approach and the contemporary rationalist, or perhaps you should say contemporary academic approach. There's many other examples of that, and statements which were shown in they would interpret them non-literally, whereas contemporary academic approach is simply to accept them literally, but not to accept them as being factual. Let's move on to another example, and that is Kazayas. Right, so certain mitzvot involving eating of a minimum quantity, and the minimum quantity is often a kazayis, right? Eating matzah on the first night of Pesach because of kazayis. What would you say? Back in the box. An olive, right? In theory, but how big is it? So people can take this, right? A third of a matzah, half a matzah, a whole matzah. So I did a study of my conclusion with size is, that's shocking, size is pretty much the size of an olive. So the question is, well, if it's the size of an olive, you know, why do people say it's much bigger? So what I realized was that if you look at the difference here between the Rishonim of Sfarad and the difference and the Rishonim of Ashkenaz. The Rishonim of Sfarad never set out to discuss the size of a kazayis. It's only the Rishonim of Ashkenaz who set out to discuss the size of a kazayis and come up with these huge quantities. Why? The answer is very simple. So the Rishonim of Sfarad didn't need to discuss the kazayis of the kazayis because they had olives. Whereas the Rishonim of Ashkenaz were not familiar with olives. Now, olives did not grow in their region. They had to figure it out as best as they could based on their practice. And there are many pieces of evidence for this. Certain Rishon from Ashkenaz who went to Israel, and he said that he saw an olive and he couldn't believe how small it was, and so on and so forth. Now, I wrote an article on this, which you can now get for free on my website, rationalistjudaism.com. Originally, I submitted it to a certain journal of halakha, and they rejected it. Why? They felt it wasn't sufficiently respectful of the Rishonim, and this idea that the Rishonim just, you know, said what gave the size of the kazayas based on what they figured out, based on their observation. So here again you see the difference between the rationalist and non-rationalist approaches. But as far as I'm concerned, when you're analysing how the Rishonim came to their descriptions of the size of the kazayas, was based on what they figured out. And Rishonim who lived in the Mediterranean basin had a tremendous advantage over Rishonim who did not live in the Mediterranean basin. But for other people, now it's unacceptable to say that, that's what went into the Rishonim's way of thinking. Okay, so there's a few examples of the difference between rationalist and non-rationalist schools with regard. Now the second topic, which is the second division, the second of three differences, which is related to this, is nature. Let me clean this whiteboard. Come on, clean the whiteboard. Hold on. I've actually clean the whiteboard. Oh, that's how. Okay. Here we go. So nature. Okay, rationalists value a naturalistic rather than supernatural interpretation of events and perceive a constant natural order over history, including the creation of the universe, the biblical period, the present and the future messianic era. Mystics prefer miracles and believe them to be especially dominant in ancient history and the future messianic era. Can people see the screen? Can people see the whiteboard? Can you type in the text box so you can see the whiteboard? No? Okay, why not? Oh. Hold on. No, I lost it. What's going on here? Here. Now you see it? Okay. Okay, so rationalists are very into nature. Very into God running the world according to the order of nature. Why? Now this is something where today people are much more familiar with the non-rationalist approach. The non-rationalist approach, which prefers to see God as running miracles, so initially that would seem preferable. Right? Of course, you want to see the hand of God, you want to see miracles. Why would you know, in the contemporary Orthodox circles, the idea is that nature is just there for free will, is to give people the possibility of blinding themselves to God, but there's nothing inherently positive about nature. So why is it that the rationalists see this positive value to the natural order. The reason is that they see it as God's greatest creation. That the greatest of God's creation is the fact that it's this orderly system of running the natural world. That's the most greatest expression of his ingenuity. We'll speak that out a little bit more soon. So, you know, given a choice of explaining something naturalistically or supernaturally, rationalists much prefer to explain it naturalistically. Just give one example, the splitting of the Red Sea. Or miracles in general. Let's start off speaking about miracles in general. So, the rationalist school of thought prefers not to explain miracles in a supernatural way. Now, why? Why would you not want to see a supernatural miracle? Because the idea is, a miracle, I'd like to give this example. It's like the difference between a PC and an Apple computer. So if you're running Windows on a PC, right, so every few days, you know, Microsoft sends out this automatic update, whereas Apple computers don't do that. So you might say, wow, you know, that means that Microsoft is so much better. The answer is no, it's just the obvious. It's just the opposite. Apple made a really good operating system in the first place that's really stable and doesn't need tinkering with. Windows, on the other hand, is a mess, so they constantly need to intervene in order to get it to do what they want it to do. So that's how the rationalist school of thought perceives a miracle. The idea is that God is so smart, he should be able to program the natural order to accomplish what he wants. If he has to intervene in order to get the desired result, it means that nature is not getting the desired result for him. It's a weakness in the operating system. So maybe on occasion there might be some historical reason why it's necessary for God to intervene and to show that he runs the show. But in general, the idea of a miracle is a very unsavory idea, because surely God should have programmed the natural order to do what he wants. And so that's, for example, why some of Shonen point out that in the splitting of the Red Sea, it says that a wind blew all night. Why? Because the idea was that God set up the natural order so that it should produce the desired results. Under certain three conditions, it would produce a splitting of the Red Sea. So that's why rationalists prefer to explain things in terms of the natural order. And that applies at many different levels. Creation of the universe. So here's something where for the medieval rationalists, they didn't really have any option of explaining it naturalistically because they couldn't think of any mechanism. Nowadays, we do have a mechanism by which to explain the development of the universe, the development of life. So rationalists are very happy to find such a thing. Whereas non-rationalists don't like it, right? They don't like the idea of explaining it naturalistically. They feel that it leads people away from God. They want to have more visible, obvious manifestations of God's wisdom. So they want to see God as, you know, adapting things into existence, not doing it according to any system of natural law. I was not comparing Bill Gates to God. I was comparing Steve Jobs. Now, do mystics believe that God makes hurricanes and tsunamis on his whim, or is it a natural event? They probably believe that some are natural and some are supernatural. Certainly with Hurricane Sandy, you know, I heard people say that it was actually not a naturalistic event. It was La Mala in Hatera, right, supernatural event. That's what I heard people claim. Okay, so creation of the universe, where for modern rationalists, where there's an option that we have understanding of how God could have done it naturalistically, so this is what's desired. Right, we'll discuss this more. I think the fourth lecture of this series is about evolution, so we'll discuss that more then. Again, the biblical period, Sandy wants to know if normal people said that Sandy was a supernatural event. Depends what you mean by normal. Ultra-Orthodox Jews, but college-educated and of a distinct mystic orientation. events in Tanakh, right, for rationalists seek to explain them naturalistically. Mystics prefer not to. Even something like the 10 plagues. So Soloveitchik in The Emergence of Ethical Man. He explains them naturalistically. He doesn't go through each one. But he points out that in general, they do seem to be naturalistic type events. And the idea then being miraculous is that these unusual naturalistic events occurred at the exact time when Moshe said that they would happen. I see, there are 10 plagues is a good example of where, again, where you see the difference between the two different schools of thought. Let's take the fourth plague. Oh, what was the fourth plague? Type it in the chat box. What was the fourth plague? Arrow, yeah, arrow. But what is arrow? Swarms, right? Hordes of what? Come on, I want to hear some suggestions. What animals were they? No, not locusts. Locusts was the later plague. Fourth plague, swarms of wild animals. What wild animals were there? What do you imagine? What, lions? Anything else? Tigers? Bears? Dinosaurs? Dinosaurs? Okay, so, I saw a very beautiful illustrated Haggadah which showed lions and gorillas and a giant octopus and a polar bear arriving in a block of ice. They're all based on certain midrashic ideas, whereas the rationalist approach would be to say, no, there's no polar bears arriving in blocks of ice from the North Pole, there's no giant octopuses coming out of the sea. And there's no gorillas or tigers which don't live in Egypt. It would be the local wild animals. Right? It would be an infestation of the local wild animals. The idea being that it's something that's within the realm of the natural order. And the miracle is that it happens when Moshe says that it's going to happen. Right? And again, that's how Soloveitchik explains it. So here too, again, you see the difference between the rationalist and non-rationalist school of thought. Right? The non-rationalist school of thought would see that as heresy. Why are you trying to minimize the supernatural? There's a rationalist say, no, the idea is that this is the genius of God, that he programs the natural order so that it can accomplish everything he wants without having to intervene. Another example of how nature expresses a difference is with the future. And like we saw earlier with that story in the Gemara, for the non-rationalists, the Messianic era involves all kinds of supernatural miracles. Right? The lion lying down with the lamb. Actually, that's the New Testament. In the Old Testament, the lion lying down with the cow. Right? And loaves of bread growing on trees and gigantic gemstones, right? It's all supernatural, a complete change in the order of nature. Whereas the rationalist, the rabbi says explicitly that there's no change in the order of nature. Okay, so that's the second example, nature, differences between rationalists and non-rationalists. And the third area of difference is the service of God. Place this in the window. Okay, you see that? Rationalists understand the purpose of mitzvos and one's religious life in general as furthering intellectual and moral goals from the individual and society. Mystics see mitzvot as performing mechanistic manipulations of spiritual or celestial forces, with their reasons being either to accomplish this or ultimately incomprehensible. Is that on the screen? Yeah? Okay. So let's give some examples of this. Mezuzah. Right, what is the mitzvah of mezuzah all about? Right. Just about. I have that mezuzah right here. I need to put it up. So, why am I putting it up? What's it going to accomplish? What's the mezuzah going to accomplish? Anyone? So, many people, usually when I ask this question, people say that the mezuzah is going to protect the home. Like if God forbid there's a house fire, or a possible potential house fire, or a burglary, the mezuzah makes this like force field protecting the home. The rationalists, on the other hand, which is by and large the Rishonim, say that, no, that's not what mezuzah does. It's not a protection. It's a reminder. Mezuzah's there, you look at it, and you think about what's written in it, it reminds you to be a good Jew. Right? So, you know, Rambam says explicitly, Rambam says that all mitzvot, no matter what, all mitzvot serve one or more of three purposes. To teach you a lesson, to improve your character, or to improve society. And according to Rambam, that's what all mitzvot do. There's some mitzvot where it's easier to understand how they do that, like honoring one's parents. There's some mitzvot like Parah Adumah, which is more hard to understand how they accomplish that, but that's what all mitzvot are there to do. For mystics, on the other hand, there may be a little bit of that involved in mitzvot, but the primary goal of mitzvot is in the realm of the supernatural, manipulating the supernatural and accomplishing all kinds of things in an invisible, metaphysical world. Right, so with mezuzah, according to the rationalist approach, mezuzah is there to remind you to be a good Jew. Whereas according to the mystics, mezuzah might does that too, but the primary goal is spiritual, manipulating various metaphysical forces, and the side effect being to protect your home. Another example, mitzvah matilas yadayim, washing your hands in the morning. What's that about? Washing off death. Okay. So we have a few different approaches. The non-rationalist approach, which is very popular these days, the idea that it's removing harmful spiritual forces of impurity that descended during the night. But the Rishonim don't mention that. The Rishonim speak instead of that hygiene, physical hygiene. They speak of the lesson, the idea that it conveys, which is, as Joe from Maine says, it's like remembering how the Kohen would wash his hands preparing for serving in the temple. So we're making a fresh start to the day, thinking about how we need to clean ourselves and spend our day serving God. Right? The idea being that it's not involved, we're not talking about any kind of a supernatural idea here. It's the idea of a physical function and an intellectual function. Right, so here's an example, you know, as we'll see with all these things, The rationalist approach was very dominant in the times of the Rishonim, especially in Spara, the medieval period, and it gradually declined. Right, another, I think, very powerful example, I think, the most starkest example in terms of serving God between the rationalist and non-rationalist approach is the mitzvah of Shiloh HaKeim. Right, the mitzvah is when you come to a bird's nest, before taking the eggs or the young, you have to send away the mother bird. Question is why? So if the rationalists, this was all about kindness and compassion. Right? The idea being that for the bird to see you taking her young is very psychologically distressing for the bird. So by sending her away, because you can't see it, you save her that distress. It's a much more compassionate way to take the eggs. For the non-rationalists, on the other hand, based off the Zohar, the Shiloh HaKeim is a completely different idea. The idea is that when you send away the mother bird, it does feel some distress, and that's the whole point. The mother bird is squawking in distress, at which point the angel in charge of birds up in heaven goes and complains to God, at which point God says, well, I'm getting complaints about the pain of a bird. Why is nobody complaining about the pain of the Jewish people in exile, about the pain of the Shechina? And why, you know, where are the protests for that? And as a result, there's an outpouring of compassion upon the Jewish people. Right, so for the Zohar, it's not about compassion on the bird. Rather, it's about being cruel to the bird. Why? In order to set this whole metaphysical process into motion, which will result in obtaining good results for the Jewish people. Now I have to say, you know, it's a very strange approach. Normally the idea is that if you want God to act compassionately for you, you should act compassionately. And here we have completely the opposite idea, that no, you have to be cruel in order to set this whole process into motion up in the heaven with the angels so for God to be compassionate upon the Jews instead. But that is a non-rational approach. And here's the case, but, you know, normally, practically speaking, there is very little difference between the rationalist and non-rationalist approach. Okay, that's one of the amazing things about Judaism, that you have these two radically different approaches to religion, which can coexist. you know, in my community, in the school I down in a very small school, and there's people who are strong rationalists and strong mystics, and it coexists. Right? Why? Because bottom line, there's very little practical difference. Right? There's very little halachic ramifications. The Shluchat Kain is one case where there is a difference. The difference being as follows. So historically, if people came across a bird's nest, you would want the eggs. That's who turned down the chance for a free meal. But nowadays, when food is very plentiful, and we're used to getting our food in supermarkets and not from the forest, but nowadays, nobody would want to, if they came across a bird's nest, nobody would want to take the eggs. I mean, I would, my egg collection. But normal people would not want to take the eggs. So if you don't want to take the eggs, is there a mitzvah sending away the mother bird? So if the rational is, no, of course not. The whole mitzvah is that if you want to take the eggs, which historically would be what people wanted to do, this is the most compassionate way to go about doing it. But if you don't want to take the eggs, then you don't do anything. For non-rationalists, on the other hand, no. The whole point of the mitzvah is you want to set this whole process into motion. You want the mother bird to be in pain, and then for the angels to complain, and for God to react by an outpouring of compassion. So whether you want the eggs or not, you're going to do it. Okay, so here's a practical difference between the two approaches. If you want to find out more about that whole topic, so I have a very in-depth monograph from Shlomo Hakeim, which again you can get at my website, rationalistjudaism.com. Now, so, as we see, right, that's basically a survey of these two radically different schools of thought. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, although my inclination is towards the rationalist approach very strongly, firstly I should say this. It's not as though people are either rationalists or mystics. It's not as though that we're dealing with a black and white here. There's a spectrum between the two. Okay, so in Shlomo Hakeim you see a very strong difference. But in general, you know, overall, there's a spectrum. And there's very few people that are either one or the other, you know, completely. Most people fall somewhere along the spectrum. They just, you know, gravitate towards more towards one pole or the other. Right, so people are 80% rationalist, 20% mystic, 20% rationalist, 80% mystic, right? People gravitate more towards one than the other. There are a few complex figures who appear to combine both. Ramban is one. Rav Kook is another. But in general, people gravitate more towards one epistemology or the other. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not out to delegitimize the mystical approach. Why not? Well, now the mystical approach has gotten much more popular. The rationalist approach was dominant in the medieval period. It gradually declined to the extent that nowadays in the Torah world, people are certainly, many people are unaware that the rationalist approach ever existed. But it declined for a reason. The reason was that the mystical approach was much more successful at keeping Jews as being passionate Jews in the face of overwhelming threats from persecution or assimilation. The fact is that people are wired differently, and for many people, the mystical approach, in which God is much more imminent, much more involved, which is much more the supernatural, that makes a much more passionate, vibrant Judaism. It's one that, you know, helps them cope a lot more with the vicissitudes of life. And for these people, you know, the rationalist approach seems sterile, may even seem heretical, you know, writing God out of the picture. Plus, the rational approach, it has got a lot of intellectual problems. You know, there are a lot of intellectual challenges that have been, you know, once you open that Pandora's box, once you let the genie out of the bottle of critical thinking and rational analysis, it's hard to put that genie back in. It leaves some people away from Judaism altogether. So the mystics have very good reason for being very wary of the rationalist approach. Conversely, the mystical approach for many people, for other people, it doesn't speak to them, it seems superstitious, it seems ridiculous. For many people, it's the rationalist approach which to them presents a much more profound view of Judaism that speaks to them. So I really think it's a question of different strokes for different folks. We need both. Now, it's hard for the two to coexist, because, you know, mystics have a tendency to see rationalists as heretics. It's unfortunate, but there you go. And rationalists have an unfortunate tendency to see mystics as idiots. So coexistence is difficult, but I think it can be attained. number one, by again remembering that there's very little in the sense of practical ramifications. Half is pretty much the same for both. And also remembering that both schools, both approaches have a long history to them, and that they all work better for different people. Now, sadly, they're asking, am I saying that the decision to take a rationalist or mystic approach is a rational decision? Yeah, it could be. That wasn't exactly what I was saying. What I was saying is that it's rational to accept that the mystic approach for many people is very beneficial, and therefore not to try to suppress it. But it could be that even for oneself, one could decide that going down the whole path of rational investigation into things is just not going to bring themselves any, they're unlikely to reach truth or spiritual satisfaction, and therefore to consciously reject it. It's certainly not everyone's cut out for it. Look, Rambam himself. Rambam did not believe that his approach was for everyone, that everyone was suited to it. There's a reason why he disguised a lot of what he wrote in the middles and so on, because he knew that it was some people would not be able to handle it. And so I think we need both approaches. Well, my goal is to, in general, is to bring to light more of the rationalist approach, because I've seen that many people, such as myself, you know, need it, and they're not aware that it used to exist. So it's good to give it an airing. But simultaneously, I'm always clear to mention its limitations, and to mention I'm very sympathetic to those who want to take a different approach, and I'm not trying to stuff this one down to anyone's throat. So I hope this has given you a taste of the different schools of thought. Again, I've written a lot about this in various monographs and on my blog. Right, even the blog is rationalistjudaism.com, where you can also download the monographs, and at some point I hope to be publishing a book on this topic, which will be a compilation of the monographs as well as some additional material. Okay, any questions? Oh, you're welcome. Nope, no questions? All right, super, because my throat's getting out. But if you do have a question, try just Google Rationalist Judaism in quotes and then the keywords, and you'll find that I've discussed a lot of these topics on my blog. So it was great to meet you all in cyberspace. Have a great week, and I will see you next Sunday.